It's Helping Hand on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Dave Lawrence. Each week, Helping Hand puts a spotlight on an organization, topic, or event that assists the disabled or the most vulnerable. And today we're continuing a recurring series on the plight of one of the most vulnerable animals on Earth, the rhinoceros, facing an exploding extinction crisis due to a false belief that their horns have value, medicinal or otherwise. Over the last 8 years, poaching has increased 6,000% due to skyrocketing demand in Vietnam and China. While virtually all rhinos are threatened by the violent wave of killings that take the life of 2 to 3 rhinos per day, one rhino species, the Sumatran rhino, has been making news for a humble resurgence. Among the rarest mammals on Earth, there are fewer than 100 thought to exist in the wild, mainly in Indonesia, with just 10 in captivity. In May, only the second Sumatran rhino in 128 years was born in captivity in its home territory. First, a male and now a female were born at the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary, where male Ondalis, born at the Cincinnati Zoo, has now sired 2 calves with a female, Ratu. His younger brother Harapan also emigrated to that facility last year and has yet to mate. Reproductive physiologist Dr. Terry Roth of the Cincinnati Zoo spoke about the significance of this latest birth of a female.
The birth of a female in particular is just, I mean, it's exactly what we needed more than anything else. Considering there's only 100 of these rhinos, approximately 100 left, any healthy calf is much needed for the population. But because we have now 3 males at the sanctuary, we really needed a female. And that's one of those things that, you know, we only have control over so many things, and that is not one of them. And so it's kind of one of those things that's just left to fate. But this time, I think fate actually smile down upon us. We're just thrilled to have a female calf.
The 2 births followed breakthrough research by Dr. Roth at the Cincinnati Zoo that unlocked the secrets to their unusual breeding process, very different process than other rhinos. Dr. Roth is credited with the groundbreaking developments that revived their captive breeding after a century, utilizing techniques that led to 3 calves born under her watch in Cincinnati.
They're very difficult to monitor just behaviorally because the female does not show when she's really obviously going to be receptive to the male. And you can't simply house them together because they're solitary animals and they fight with each other if you put them together. So it really became a game of trying to figure out the reproductive physiology so that we knew the exact day or potentially days that the female would be receptive to the male. That just really evolved around hormone monitoring, and we did a lot of ultrasound work where we actually could look directly at the ovaries and see what was developing on those ovaries. And eventually we learned that part of the reason it was so difficult was because this is a species that's an induced ovulator. She only ovulates when she's introduced to a male for breeding, and as long as people are keeping them separate, she's not going to ovulate. But eventually we did figure it all out, and we know exactly how long their reproductive cycle is. Just mapping out their cycles and figuring out how to breed them wasn't the only problem. They seem to be really susceptible to pregnancy loss. Here in Cincinnati, when our female first became pregnant, she lost her first pregnancy and went on to lose 4 more pregnancies. So we went through 5 basically miscarriages. This was before any calf, you know, we were still trying to work on producing the first calf from this program, and we kept losing them. And we had to put her on a hormone supplement before she finally carried her 6th pregnancy to term.
And that's part of the secret which goes towards Ratu's success, right? Both of these times she's been on that hormone supplement.
Exactly.
Dr. Susie Ellis is executive director of the nonprofit International Rhino Foundation, who raised the funds to build the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary. And she spoke to HPR from the site just a few days after the birth.
We had a projected window of delivery. She actually went a little bit late with this pregnancy. And so by the time the night of delivery came, I think everybody was antsy. But at about 4 o'clock, someone knocked on my door and said, "It's coming." And so everybody went into the video room to watch the birth. Because this is such a sensitive thing, only her keepers and the veterinarians were present.
Some of the keeper staff and management here have moved on to other jobs, so they asked me to come back just as a kind of help advise what's going to happen.
That's Cincinnati zookeeper Paul Reinhardt, who spoke to HPR last year when he accompanied Harapan on his trip from Cincinnati to Indonesia and returned to be part of the team for the birth last month due to his expertise acquired in raising the Cincinnati Zoo's first Sumatran rhinos born in captivity.
Any healthy birth that goes as well as it did is a treat, a blessing, however you want to describe it. But a female was hoped for, and that's what she had, and it was extra good news that that's how it turned out.
And a good, healthy birth is not only critical for the rarest of rhinos, but at this point, rhinos in general, as they face possible extinction in the wild within 10 years if immediate measures aren't taken to stop the poaching. But saving them isn't so easy, as even the rhino's closest allies have somewhat differing opinions on how to tackle the crisis. Again, Dr. Terry Roth from the Cincinnati Zoo. Do you support mass translocations, things like the Australian Rhino Project or efforts to take them to safer places?
I'd have to say that I do, in general, support the idea of insurance populations located in other areas. And I would say that even if it wasn't rhinos and poaching, but for endangered species in general, we've just seen things go badly too quickly when you have these single populations or populations in one country where there's an outbreak of something or that goes awry. I've always been a supporter of having these insurance populations. Now, whether or not that's Australia with 1,000 rhinos or whether that's Texas or whether that's just the zoo community that has the insurance population, I'm not exactly sure which is the best way to handle that. And all are probably complicated, but I think we should have them. In this day and age, we don't look at countries separately anymore. We are one big global population. I just think it really makes sense.
Dr. Susie Ellis from the International Rhino Foundation also addressed the topic of relocating rhinos. Is that a plan that you guys endorsed?
Well, we know details about it. It's not a plan we've endorsed. There are a lot of objections to it within South Africa. But if it's a well-managed XCG population as an insurance policy, I don't have any problem with that. It's just that there is such a challenge right now in South Africa to conserve rhinos and protect them. I hate to see funds diverted away from that effort. The poaching crisis is the worst it's ever been, you know, no question about that. But if you can imagine if someone came to Hawaii, for example, and said, you know, you guys don't know how to manage your endangered forest birds, so we're going to take them to Australia to keep them safe. You can imagine how we would feel. Well, the South Africans feel exactly the same way, if you can put yourself in their shoes.
Actually, it's a good example, because if it wasn't for the San Diego Zoo coming out here and protecting our native crow, the Alala, we wouldn't have it. And, I mean, the crows live in captivity based on people from San Diego Zoo who established the facility. So I think the answer would be a little different here. Dr. Roth points out a similar strategy is underway elsewhere.
There's a great program in Australia trying to save the Tasmanian devil, and they are purposely sending those animals to Europe and to the United States and to other places so that they have these other pockets of hopefully protected and sustainable populations. And I think that's very smart.
Another smart move in the view of Cincinnati zookeeper Paul Reinhart is education.
If we can almost daily get the word out that these animals deserve more, I know people out there feel strongly about these animals being around forever. And the real way to doing that is through education.
And that includes education about rhino horn.
There are studies out there about rhino horn, and to a large extent, most of them say there is absolutely no evidence that it has any medicinal properties. One response would be to say that basically the rhino horn consists of keratin. Keratin is the same thing that is in your fingernails. So if you think that chewing your fingernails is going to help cure your illness, then that's what you should be doing instead of using rhino horn. It's the exact same material. There's a flip side to that, though, because in reality, there's a second market for rhino horn that does not have anything to do with necessarily the medicinal properties of rhino horn. In Vietnam, it's become a status symbol. In high society circles, it seems to be the in thing is to serve rhino tea. So people are doing it just as a part of their high society image instead of doing it for medicinal reasons, and that market seems to be exploding.
The nonprofit International Rhino Foundation is online at rhinos.org, where you can make a donation to their efforts to protect rhinos, learn more about the extinction crisis, and share that information with others. This feature, the complete interviews, all the contact details, video of the birth, and other resources, plus all of our other Helping Hand segments, are archived online at hawaiipublicradio.org.